As the eponymous host of The Greg Gutfeld Show, which airs Saturday evenings on Fox News, co-host of that same network's hugely popular afternoon talk show, The Five,
Tonight, Red Eye,
and creator of the defunct path-breaking late-night show Red Eye, Greg Gutfeld is one of the most ubiquitous presences on cable news. A prolific writer and former editor of Maxim and Stuff magazines, Gutfeld has a new book out, The Gutfeld Monologues, Classic Rants from the Five. Reason sat down with the libertarian-leaning conservative to talk about his new book, Punk Rock, and just how great it would be if Rosie O'Donnell challenged Donald Trump in the 2020 election.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason, and I am sitting down with Greg Gutfeld, the co-host of The Five, and I guess you have something to do with The Greg Gutfeld Show.
Yes, it was named after me.
Okay, but yeah. other than that, you just licensed the name?
I have nothing to do with it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just an imposter.
Your new book is The Gutfeld Monologues, Classic Rants from The Five. Mm-hmm. Beyond the paycheck, what prompted this, and what's the elevator pitch for why people should read the rant?
Because people who watch The Five were asking for a place where they could find the monologues, and I kept getting asked that question all over. So I just thought, well, this is a really easy project. I'll just collect them all and put them in one spot.
You describe in the opening of the book your big mistake about Trump and Trump's election. Tell that story.
I was like 99% of everybody in media who just assumed he was going to be shellacked. I was told that day by experts that by 9 o'clock he would be conceding. That's it.
Wow, America, we really did it this time. And you know it's good when the media is losing their
While this was going on, I had ignored people who weren't in the media who were my close friends. I have a buddy who's a cop. I have a buddy who runs a steakhouse, Westside Steakhouse, down on 10th, if you're there.
Wait, do we get a coupon?
Yes,
there a discount code?
Their steaks are quite good, and so is their bacon. But he would always say, don't count the guy out, Greg. Yeah. He kept saying that. His name's Nick. And my buddy's a cop would say the same thing. I have
Do you have a cab driver?
I have a cab driver. I have a focus group of regular people.
Yeah, you have the village people.
Yes, exactly.
Like construction workers.
And they all have to dress in uniform when I talk to them. Let's bring in the police officer. And he does a little dance. Yeah. No, my point is I was ignoring everybody, including my friends from college in California. And I was just like, you don't know. You don't work. You don't understand what this is like. He's going to win. But that day, I had this little New York Times. It's on my phone, that app that showed the percentage that Hillary would win, like 99%.
Yeah, it was the confidence ratio or something. Like she was going to win, she had 90% interval or whatever.
So I was sitting there. I had to do a 5 at 5 o'clock and then another one around midnight or something. And so I went to this bar and I had it was at 95%. And I was talking to the bouncer, one of my regular friends, the bouncer.
Yeah, no,
and he said, what are the odds? And I said, she's got it in the bag. And he just became distraught, Anyway, as I was sitting at the bar, I just kept noticing this app changing. And I was going, now it's at 80%. Now it's at 70%. And I'm starting to get a little bit weirded out. Because
Were you going to say you were getting worried because that meant you were going to have to sober up and go back on TV or something?
No, actually, I only had one glass of wine. And I maintained that
and
in the book.
You're a terrible liar.
Repeatedly. Yes. Repeatedly. I was worried because I didn't know what to think from a personal level, what happens when you're completely wrong. Like, what's the world going to look like?
This is a new world for you. You've
never been wrong. And it is like, my God, this is a big, but everybody was wrong, except for maybe 5 people. And like I say in the book, I'm not even sure that President Trump thought he was going to win. So that whole chapter is about coming to terms with this earthquake. It was really probably one of the most momentous political upheavals I think I've lived through.
You talk critically about Trump, but also you really hate people who hate Trump.
Yeah.
What is your relationship with him? Because didn't he also was a guest or he was in a sketch that opened the Greg Gutfeld Show?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
He was very friendly before he ever was running. You have to understand there's something that unites interesting people, and it's watching Red Eye. You were a fan of Red Eye. So was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
People that were up late at night, recovering alcoholics or alcoholics, breastfeeding mothers, meth heads, truck drivers, college kids, not college kids, you name it. They were united by this really weird show. And Donald Trump watched it. I mean, he didn't just watch it. He knew the show. So he called me up a couple of times about Red Eye. And he'd tell me how funny it was. And he knew all the players. like everything from Bill to Andy to then Joanne. And so we ended up very nice. My show opened. We did a segment where I interviewed him about whether he would run for president. And then I jokingly was auditioning to be his press secretary. It was a joke.
We've heard these rumors that you might run for president. And I was wondering, if you do and you win, what would be my role?
Well, I think you'd be a fantastic press secretary. Mm-hmm. You know, would finally have a little personality in that position.
Yeah. I remember I asked him, I go, are you really going to, this was off camera. Uh-huh. And I said, are you going to run? He goes, Greg, I can't tell you anything, but when it happens, you're not going to see anything like it. You're not going to see anything like it. I mean, it's just going to be amazing. And he was right. I mean, I didn't know what he meant. Like, I mean, it was like in his head, he knew that something was going to break when he was going to do it. And it was, I didn't believe him because he'd said it before. He had talked about running a lot.
Yeah, and he, going in back 2000, to,
yeah,
he
was, the, yeah. What was the party with Perot?
Ross Perot. Or the Reform Party, or Jesse Ventura, or something like that. So what is your attitude towards Trump? Because a lot of the monologues are about how, you know, people hate Trump and they become deranged by, you know, or Trump derangement syndrome. But do you like him? Do you dislike him? Like, what is your sense of, what's your sense of
I've
him?
Come to understand him as kind of as a character, and a character whose words are cheap. In the way that my words are cheap, and that I talk a lot, and he talks a lot. So his opinions are his opinions, and he'll change them. And what happens with, I think, with the media and the virulent or the angry anti-Trumpers is that they see everything he says as somehow an attempt to do something.
I think it was a reporter named Selena Zito who said that Trump's critics take him literally but not seriously.
Yes, yeah.
His admirers take him seriously but not literally.
And I would say that as a critic, I was in that camp. So once he became elected, I switched. Like I decided, okay, he's now the president. I'm going to focus solely on deeds. And let his, look, I continue to get mad over his words, but I'm going to like crack a rib. You know, you can't be outraged every day. It's like if you have an uncle that comes over and says rude things, and you've known him for 40 years and you still get upset, that's on you. You just have to live with it.
So what are the deeds that he's done that you like?
I like, well, the first thing I have to say was the climate change, getting out of that, the accords. Not because I don't believe in climate change. I just didn't believe in that deal. And I think, you know, one of the things he said was it was a lousy deal. I think he believes in climate change, but I don't know. I mean, I don't want to mind read, but he just knew that that was a lousy deal. And there's people like, who does the Copenhagen consensus? Bjorn Lomborg.
Yeah.
Like he'll talk about how it takes like $30 trillion to solve all the world's problems, but the $100 trillion for the climate accords would keep Celsius from increasing like that. So it was just like such a, not a scam, but a terrible deal. So I thought that was really, really good. I'm into the deregulation stuff. Yeah. I the Supreme Court, I'm fine with. Those are just things. So I think he's in his heart, he's a pacifist. He doesn't strike me as somebody who wants to waste blood and treasure. But I could be wrong. I don't know yet.
You've been wrong before in this interview.
Nick, so I've been wrong. Like, just I have being in your presence, I've been wrong. I'm already regretting talking to you.
What? I'm regretting setting this up myself.
Yes.
So we have that in common.
I'm filled with regret.
He speaks highly of people like the police in a way that, you know, change things. What do you mean by that?
Well, he saw an opening, and I think it was always, maybe he was always this way, but I call it the stool. I'm trying to remember what it was. The stool of security, which was like national security, law and order, and borders. And they all kind of go together as like a safer world. And so he could, for that to work, you have to have the antithesis. So he was coming in after, I'd say, 3 or 4 years of some serious police bashing on other networks in which they looked at brutality as not a bug in the system, but the system itself. So when you saw a case of something horrible happening, which we had seen, that meant all police were bad. And all it took was a politician, and I was doing this on The Five a lot, which was, this is not a system, this is a bug in the system. And you'd get these really sobering statistics that were even in the Washington Post and New York Times about how misleading the media was about police shootings. And they found that in some cases, some police officers are more likely to shoot than others. And it was like, it went against the narrative that they were pushing out. I think that gave an opening. There are a couple of things like that. Look at not being able to say radical Islam might be a small ball for a lot of people, but it was an opening to say, I'm going to say it, radical Islam. And everybody goes, finally, somebody's saying it and not calling it workplace violence. So that was an opening in the national security thing. What's wrong with having a border? I mean, what's wrong with having, you know, build a wall? Like, that was an open. I mean, that's, I think, the opening. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily whether you agree with him or not, but he could sense that all of these things together kind of made this persona.
How much do you think it was him and, I mean, you know, it's incredible that he won. I mean, I think everybody has to admit that,
yeah,
because this guy has, like, no fucking place being, you know, doing this, and he pulled it off. A lot of it was.
But isn't
that
the reason? Shouldn't that make you happy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I mean, I like.
He had no place.
He showed that the two-party system is kind of a joke.
Yeah.
But it's also, he ran against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. How important was that? And what do you do now when you're at The Five? You have your own show. Fox is, I wouldn't say is objectively pro-Trump, but it's Trump-friendly out of the cable networks,
right,
and you don't have Hillary Clinton around to bash anymore.
You know what's amazing is that we're doing today, as we tape this interview, a segment on Hillary and Chelsea, because Chelsea's talking about running and Hillary's getting back involved to do fundraising. They aren't away, and I love that they're around, and and I mentioned that in the book, that she's like, she's, you know, constantly being moved around, and it's like, the more she's around, because I need to have something fun, just to lampoon and she provides so much information, so much fodder. So I don't think she's going away. And by the way, I argue, and no one listens to me, the same way Rocky II was anticipated, Hillary Trump II, a rematch, would be the biggest political event in history. And all the people who didn't vote for Hillary because they thought she had it in the bag would be out in force. It'd be like, be like with Brexit.
To remember the plot to Rocky II.
Neither do I. It might be a terrible analogy. Was Apollo Creed?
Yeah, it had to be against Apollo Creed.
And then
But then it was Rocky III where he takes on Mr. T, right?
Yes.
And Apollo Creed is training him.
Clubber Lang.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, it was probably an awful analogy, but sequels. This sequel.
So it's like The Godfather 2.
Yes, Godfather 2.
Which won the best picture.
Yeah. I think the Democrats hate Hillary so much they won't give her the chance. But could you?
Yeah.
The comparison would be when you hear about the people who didn't vote during the Brexit thing, mm-hmm, now saying, we want another vote so we can vote. That's kind of what this would be.
But aren't you, I mean, you are, what are you, like 54, 55, something like that?
I'm in my early 30s.
Okay.
Nice try.
I'm sorry. You know, it's the body parts that have been replaced. Your liver is in its
also,
early 50s.
I exude the wisdom of a man mid-century old.
But aren't you disgusted by the idea that it's going to be, you would have an election with two, like, 75-year-olds?
It's crazy. But it's like Joe Biden.
Yeah, he's still around. Elizabeth Warren is 100 years old.
I mean, isn't it weird that those are our only choices?
It's like even the Soviets at the end were like putting in 50-year-olds.
Yeah, do you know I think it's a theory in the book, but I can't remember if it's in the book or not. The reason why Trump won was this contrast theory. Like you had 17 similars and one that stood out. Even Carly Fiorina. Blended in, even as a woman, blended in with the rest. And Rand Paul, who's different, blended in with the rest. But you had like 17 politicians and one guy. I think that's going to happen with the Democrats. They're going to have, I hope my hands are clean.
Yeah.
I rode the subway. And
I didn't realize you have six fingers on your hand either.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing what I can do with that sixth finger. But anyway, so you have Democrats could have a dozen people. Right. And you could have Kamala Harris, you could have Liz Warren, Joe Biden, but then you could have like an outlier. And I know people think I'm joking when I say Mark Ruffalo or even Rosie O'Donnell. I say Rosie O'Donnell
because
people laugh at Trump. But think about Rosie, reality show, talk show, conspiracy, outspoken, and I think kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, she'll take it. She'll take it to Trump in a way.
Yeah.
That was part of the problem with the Republicans when. Jeb Bush, like, I think he started to cry when Trump was like, "You're low energy."
How do you deal with it? It's like you just branded me, and I can't unbrand myself. And then you had Mario attempting to mimic Trump, and it just made Mario look kind of smaller.
Marco Rubio.
Boy, how long have I forgotten about him?
Yeah.
Mario Rubio.
Yeah, Mario Cuomo Rubio.
I was talking about Mario Cuomo yesterday. Marco Rubio, who was my first choice.
Really?
Yes.
Why? Because he's short?
Yes, we both short people have to stick together. And he had a boat.
Yeah.
He had a boat. I like people with
any,
boats.
Any metrosexual?
He had
the Cuban heel boots.
I did. I was the editor of Men's Health.
Yeah.
So maybe he was like a subscriber. That
I
could
bet
have
he
worked.
Was. Yeah, he does.
But I realized that he was still kind of a politician,
right,
like everybody else. I talked to Shapiro. I did and he's like, he was Ted Cruz all the way, right? Ted Cruz. But do you think Ted Cruz would have been ridiculed any lesser than Trump? No. Mm. He would be supremely punchable for a liberal. They would have gone after him.
I got to tell you right now, Ted Cruz is pretty punchable for a libertarian. I think for just about everybody on the political spectrum.
He said something silly the other day. Anyway, we're digressing. My point is, we say that Trump was the most vulnerable candidate, and I believe that, and that's why Hillary thought it was funny and CNN thought it was funny to prop him up. But look how they treated Mitt Romney. They treated him awful. They treated John McCain awful. They would have eaten, I think, Marco alive on his pro-life stance. And Ted Cruz would have offered Saturday Night Live endless. So I think Trump actually, looking back on it, 2020, was like the most battle-ready for
2016.
Hindsight.
Oh, I see. Oh, 2020 hindsight. Okay.
That's
so
true.
So one of the sections of the book, I'm thinking about Rosie O'Donnell, and you also spend a lot of time talking about Alec Baldwin, mm-hmm, who's kind of gone missing, and that's kind of a loss for public discourse. Hollywood is integral to, like, your theory of why Trump was, you know, became a viable alternative. Discuss that.
The less you know about something, the more strongly you feel about something. And so you have a group of people in Hollywood that have spent a lot of time apolitical, looking out for themselves and their careers, becoming famous. And all of a sudden, they reach a point in their lives where they wonder if they're intellectually irrelevant. Like, and suddenly they start looking at causes. And they really believe it, like Leo DiCaprio and the environment. But the issue is, they're kind of at the high school level at that point in politics. And so they have the passion, they have the sincere passion, but they don't have the wisdom. And the more passion they have, the less wisdom they have. So they're almost entirely wrong on everything. And now that they lost, all they have is that passion. And they are angry and they're broken. That election was one big trigger event.
Do you think regular Americans dislike Hollywood? Or do they like it? I mean, because, you know, we consume more and more entertainment.
Yeah.
But then is that the same thing as Hollywood? And what's the disconnect there? And the reason I'm bringing this up is you mentioned in the book, I mean, you were tight with Andrew Breitbart, mm-hmm, who is famous for saying that politics is downstream from culture. So how does this work? Because we, on a certain level, people are watching more entertainment than ever.
Yeah.
But it seems that people hate Hollywood more and more.
Maybe it's that thing where you love video games, but you don't know anything about the video game companies, you know, and maybe that's where we are with Hollywood. A good example, the VMAs were Sunday night. It used to be for shows like Red Eye and The Five and Fox News, and this was like, you could do like three segments on it. And I'm talking like 10 years ago. And when I worked in magazines, I used to go to these things and they were a big deal. You saw the biggest stars. Now it's like there was no hype. There's no buzz. It came and went. I didn't even know it was on until I looked on Twitter and it said VMAs was trending. And I turned it on and it was just like, it was like pantomiming the VMAs from 15 years ago. It was as though they were historical reenactors of pop culture. It was meaningless. And I think that's also a healthy sign. We don't find them interesting. You're seeing numbers go down for the Oscars. And I think the numbers for the VMAs must be at their
low. And yet, am I right to think that you at times are topping like Real Time with Bill Maher?
I don't look at their numbers, but we're number one on Saturday evenings more than anybody in the demo. My theory is...
And the demo being...
What is it, 18 to 54, something like that? I think.
I love that, by the way.
I may
like,
not
because
be the
18-year-olds and 54-year-olds.
Exactly like, alike.
Yeah, they all want the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Some of them do, sadly, in Hollywood, that is. Usually the 15-year-old wants the 18-year-old.
You know, I thought we had stipulated we're not talking about Asia Argento at all.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Oh, my God. Crazy stuff.
The Five was a mid, like, summer replacement show, right? And they were trying to figure out what to...
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck left. And so, like, why is The Five popular?
I have my theories, but it's improvisational conversation between people who like each other. And me.
Yeah.
Yes, and me. But everybody has to actually... If somebody is on there, because we're obviously having different people on there now, with talking points, mm-hmm. and they are talking points, and they kind of look at the camera, no, you got to beat this conversation. But my number one thing that I think that the reason why The Five worked and why Red Eye worked and Gigi is teasing. You got to be, if you don't like somebody, you can't tease them. Mm. And so why The Five took off is because I was sitting there teasing Dana almost every day. Kimberly was teasing me. Bob was teasing Eric. There was all this, it was just like, it's not what you saw in a normal show. People, and obviously with Red Eye, I mean, Bill Schultz was the repulsive sidekick. He was the punching bag. And Andy Levy, the libertarian, would come in and like admonish me for being a right-wing hack.
Why did, two things, and obviously Red Eye survived when you moved on with Tom Shalhoub.
Yeah, before he killed it.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got that touch. He's the Mengele of late night TV, right?
Terrible.
But, you know, why didn't any other network replicate Red Eye? And also, Fox seemed to undersell it. Like, they should have been rerunning it so much more, because it did really well, and it was a real unique show.
I think people tried it, but they couldn't figure out the secret, which was chemistry and teasing. Like, and also, it was the reason why I know you liked it, and I mean... It was weird.
I was so disappointed. When I finally got to be on it, I was so disappointed that it wasn't taped at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
That struck me as the most magical thing about it.
It's the weirdest show, I think. Mm. Like, I go back to maybe Fernwood Tonight as a weird show. Mm-hmm. That, like, how did this happen? Because Red Eye, I didn't think about how it was happening. But we just kept adding, like, subversive touches. Where there was a host that's interested in... unicorns who shouldn't be, weird stories about houseboys, mm-hmm. and then you had like Andy and his cats, and Bill just dragged in through the God knows where on the back of a cab, mm-hmm. you know, and it was just such a weird, it was a universe, and we did so many weird things. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason why it was undersold is that nobody was watching it on the, like most people at Fox were not watching it except the overnight crew. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, you know, I would say like maybe, you know, they saw 10 episodes out of the 1,000.
How are things at Fox? Because there's been, you know, I mean, beyond the resignation or the, you know, Roger Ailes being forced out with the change in leadership in various, a lot of personnel changes. How did that affect, like, what were you aware of kind of the sexual issues going on? And then, like, is the morale there upbeat or downbeat?
I think that it's, like, in recovery, which is a weird phrase to put it. But it's like, it was such an unusual time, and it prefaced what happened late in everywhere else. Do you know what I mean? With the Weinstein stuff, it just happened to us first. And I think it was jarring, and I think if you know, I can't get into the details, but it was fairly surreal, and it's sometimes just sad. And then, but now, when you look back and you see that 70% or 75% of the 75, three of the four nighttime shows are gone, I think. And our ratings have never been better. And that is, to me, a testament to the resiliency of the company, but also the resiliency of the fans, that the fans stuck by us and didn't go up. That's it. I'm out of here. You guys suck. No, they're like, I go and I do these book tours, and there are people that are just, you know, they love Tucker. You know, they love the changes, and so that's important. I mean, there are people that go, that, you know, what happened? But at the same time, it's like, well, this, and also it's 20 years, it's been 20 years. There's a lot of changes that happen in that time. It just seems like it happened a lot in one time.
What are you finding on campuses or on book tours as it relates to college-age kids?
I think they're being unfairly maligned as being sheep or just... toting the left-wing line. there's a lot more than I've ever seen who are just independent thinkers, a lot of libertarians, a lot of kids for that find Trump interesting, but they also find the whole, they've also learned more about the system. There's more of people like me when I was young than I've ever seen, like people that just think it's hilarious.
What went into you as and I realize you did go to Catholic school, so it probably has something to do with the priest, but no, what went into you as a makeup to, you know, when you look at
you were
conservative, some, you know, with some libertarian flavors, you're into punk and pop music and stuff. Where did that come from, and why do you think that is kind of replicating now?
And then with the punk rock, I mean, that was like my first love. Was, you know, music. I had three older sisters, so I got into music, you know, a fairly early age. And then when 76 or 77 rolled around, it was like that just became my life. That was all I did, was listen to and go to concerts, and I saw everybody when I was living in Northern California.
What did you like about it?
Like, The Clash was a very emotional left-wing band, but I didn't really know I didn't know what he was really saying, but I could recite all the lyrics, but not exactly know what he's talking about. And of course, the Sex Pistols were just frightening people when you're like 16. And the Ramones were frightening. They were all frightening. And I think that's what made it, like, I thought, these guys are like in 3 minutes doing amazing, crazy stuff. So that's what kind of, you know, I guess that's what did it. And they were melodic. I guess, you know, it was just, I think punk got maligned. It was just basic melodic pop songs. Turned up, the Buzzcocks, you know, that's a girl group in some ways.
Yeah, and I mean, the Ramones are essentially doing girl group songs in a lot of ways. And, the Sex Pistols, it's always odd when, I remember hearing that and being like, oh yeah, that is noise, and it's beautiful noise, but actually it's like Beatles songs.
It's Beatles songs, yeah. And you know, I got back into Misfits because they've been, Misfits are massive fans of, from Red Eye to the Gigi Show and the Five, and so Jerry Only came to the show and brought me cannolis. He's a great guy. He's the bass player for Misfits.
Did he come over from like Lodi, New Jersey,
yes,
or whatever?
Yeah, still there. But like I'm listening, so I go back and I'm listening to Static Age, which was an album from '78, but was shelved. Is as good as any punk album. It is good, but somehow they just couldn't get a deal. And I realized that Misfits, if they had gotten that deal, would have been as big as the Ramones or the Damned, I think. The melodies and Danzig's singing is like, really, he was Elvis. He was Elvis in front of a punk band.
Your roots were in print journalism.
Yeah.
Do you miss that? Do you miss, obviously you're writing books and whatnot, but, and is print, print obviously isn't dead, but is, are we in a new age of talk? Because you're doing podcasts as well as you.
I think you
must talk like 30 hours a day.
I do. I can't shut up. And I do, you could ask my staff, I do talk to myself, which is like totally unnecessary. Like I should be conserving that energy, but I will be muttering, like I'll just be muttering constantly. And even, and it's like, it's a very weird thing. Print is interesting because I'm still writing, but it ends up on blogs. I got a piece coming out this week on social media mobs. But there's some things I don't miss. And I work. You probably didn't run into this, but when I was in General Men's magazines, the pomposity and the pretentiousness and the overpayment, it was all there in New York publishing. It was like GQ, our competitors, Esquire, they were writing for other editors, not for readers, and they were just piling in the advertising dollars. But it was not like people were really into
it. And that world seems very dead. I mean, you worked at Maxim,
yes,
and which
Felix, I drove that into the ground. That was in England.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, and Felix Dennis, the publisher, I worked for a version of. I worked for him at the nadir of his career. I would like to think that I caused the nadir of his career. But when he successfully, he destroyed men's magazines by coming up with Lad magazines.
Yeah, it was. He saw it and ran with it, but it was Loaded. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Loaded? James Brown's, and I ended up working for James Brown for a great magazine called Jack, if you ever find it. It was like this big. It's amazing. But anyway, before that was Loaded. Loaded was the first, and it was kind of came out of that kind of, I guess, rave culture, drug taking, Primal Scream music. And it was like, that was the punk, that was the the finger, giving the finger to GQ and to Esquire and to Arena, those kinds of magazines. And then Maxim copied it, but FHM copied that and got huge in England, but Maxim got massive in the United States. Right. It was like, and that was a lot due to a lot of, you know, Mark Golan, who was the real, I think the first editor to really take this to a different level of like humor. It was because Maxim wasn't necessarily funny until Golan took
it over. It had an interesting sensibility in some of the earlier Dennis publications of where you were super fans, but you made fun of your idols.
Yes.
And that was what was new. And you saw that in ESPN, did that in sports, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real cultural turn that I think caught a lot of people unawares. And I think we're still in that.
If I look back, like I was talking to
a regular guy,
a fireman,
a street sweeper, a baker,
a fireman baker. He puts out fires in the daytime, and then he bakes the best bread. A person who was involved, a blogger who worked at Gawker, and we were talking about like I don't think you can do the stuff that was done in my British Maxim or in Stuff magazine. I don't think you could do that stuff anymore. I think it's like we have changed what is defined as humor, and now it's like humor is only humorous if it doesn't offend one person. So there's a real danger, like if the jokes that I was making in 2000 right now, or even in Men's Health, I guess, even the jokes back then, would be
prostates are not funny.
No, they're okay, not. Yeah. Well, some people don't have them,
yeah.
Nick. So the assumption of doing, you know, that's...
Yeah, you're already losing half the audience.
You might have prostate phantom syndrome. But you have to be really, really careful now about the... It's amazing. One person can galvanize over anything you say.
You ended up being fired, right, for a stunt that was kind of legendary in the day. Rehearse that for us.
I was asked to speak at a conference on how to create buzz for magazines, and it featured the editors of Rolling Stone and O and I think Glamour and something. So the conference, people would be up on a dais and tell you how to create buzz for your magazine. They called me. I was at Stuff, which was the sister publication of Maxim. I said, screw you. I don't need to do this. And I hung up, and then I heard that they hired Keith Blanchard from Maxim to sit in for me. And I'm going, boy, I screwed up, didn't I? And I started thinking about it, and I go, so I called him up and I buy 3 tickets to be in the audience. And then I called my friend Jeffrey Beecher, who used to run Comedy Madhouse, which I think now is in Vegas, and he can get anybody and anything. And I said, hey, could you locate 3 little people for me? And he goes, when? Because he could. And so it was like, by Thursday or whatever. And he goes, yeah, I got it. No problem. I just pay him $100 each. And that was it. So then I had to go to L.A. to do for a photo shoot with Pam Anderson. Bill Schultz is at the buzz at the event. So he's kind of like the little person manager. And so they show up. One's dressed as a gangster. One's dressed as a professor. And I think one's dressed as a British person, though I can't remember, with a cane and a monocle. But they had clipboards. And so they sat in various parts of the auditorium, and I don't even know how big it was, but so the people start talking, and all of a sudden their phones are vibrating, and they're vibrating on a clipboard, so you hear this bzzz, bzzz, so they're creating buzz. So the thing is, I'm 3,000 miles away, whatever, and I'm creating buzz in a thing about buzz. So what happened was they entered the auditorium with clipboards and their phones, and so when their phones rang, they were on vibrate, so they vibrated on a clipboard, and so they were making buzzing noises. So in effect, we were creating buzz in a place that was purporting to tell you how to create buzz, and I wasn't there. So what happened was, as this was going on, like Cindy Levy, I think is her name, said, can you please turn off your phone? And one of them goes, is it because I'm short? And so they were like, they had the armor that they could do this. And people were then a little bit scared. And so they were eating bags of potato chips, crunching, and then throwing questions out, like, why does Rolling Stone suck, was one of their questions. So finally, people were turning on Keith Blanchard because they thought, oh, it had to be the Maxim guy. But it was me, and I was not around. And Bill Schultz was in the, who I ended up hiring for Red Eye, who was in watching everything. And he said that there was, at one point, some brave woman stood up and said, can't we just agree that there's something going on here, that this is like, we're ignoring that there's something happening. And people were like, they finally got security. I think it was after 15 or 20 minutes, had to come in and take him out. And they went outside. And then I get a call from management, not Felix, but Steve, I think it was Steve Colvin, who was the president under him. And he said, Greg, there's an event that went on. And I go, that was me. And he goes, that was you? And I go, yes, that was me. And he goes, why did you tell me? And I go, but you would have said no. And he goes, yes, you're right. I would have said no. And then that was kind of it. And I go, it's great. It's like, and it was in every newspaper. It was like, this is awesome. This is what stuff is supposed to do. We're supposed to create anarchy and pranks and we created buzz. I showed them how to create buzz. That was the whole point. But after a while, it was kind of like, we've had enough of this person. He's becoming kind of a little bit, he's outgrown his job.
God damn it, you're a loose cannon.
Yes, I'm a loose cannon. And so they promoted me. Yeah. To director of brand development. They gave me a raise and they sent me to LA for a year to stay out of trouble, like get them away from the brand.
The epilogue to the Gutfeld monologues is titled, This is the End, My Friends.
Yes.
Explain that literary allusion and why should people... I
guess that was an allusion to Jim Morrison from the great song, The End. I guess, I don't even know if I was trying, but maybe it's the fact that I was just so apocalyptoed out. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Everything's the every day is the end of the day, the end of the world. Every day is the end of the world, and there should I think the media should do a correction every day that said, "Yesterday we told you it was the end of the world. We regret to inform you that it wasn't," and then they just keep going.
Well, we are going to leave it there. We have been talking with Greg Gutfeld. You can watch him 5 days a week on The Five. You can watch him once a week on The Greg Gutfeld Show, and you can read his latest book, Monologues. Thanks so much, Greg.
My pleasure, Nick. You look great as always.
You're a terrible liar, Greg Gutfeld.